Well, WoWo's Don Chevalet is joining us here on the history of WoWo.com. And Don, welcome, first of all, to the website.
Thank you very much.
Let's just recap a little bit for people who don't remember. What air shift did you have at WoWo, and when did you get there?
I arrived there in December of 1959. I replaced a guy named Marvin Hunter on the evening show, and also on a program called Program PM, which was a program that all Westinghouse radio stations had. It was a talk show with a lot of community stuff. Then they moved me on to the afternoon air shift when Bob Chase went off the air into the promotion department. And so I took over the afternoon shift and did that. And then at nights, Bob and I did sports. You know, we did hockey, common hockey games. We did college football games, college basketball. And then I was there until into 1968. I can't tell you exactly the month. And that's kind of what happened.
Can you remember that first station lineup when you were there in 1959?
Well, yeah, definitely. So the disc jockeys were called the Fabulous Four.
Mm-hmm.
I replaced this Marvin Hunter, and I joined the other three, who, of course, were Bob Sievers, Jack Underwood, and Bob Chase, and myself, and we were the Fabulous Four. And stayed that way throughout the early 60s and up into the mid-60s. And then we got a new program director. He came in and decided they wanted to make some changes and get off of this Fabulous Four thing. And we went into some handics with cats and all. They decided to call us the Pussycats. Can you believe that? That lasted a short while, and then they decided to change it to the Top Cats. Of course, we did all kinds of promotions with top hats and, you know, in black formal attire and everything. I have a lot of photos for you that you can use that'll show that.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually that was changed over to the Aces, the Air Aces, or the Aces of the Air.
Yeah.
And then we were all around in these World War One air flying uniforms and the, you know, the leather helmets and the goggles and all kinds of shenanigans we did. And that went on, and then meantime I left the station. After that, they kind of dissolved the gimmickry like that, and they didn't, I don't think they called the disc jockeys any, you know, any particular name. I think after the Air Aces, that was kind of the end of that. So that's kind of what happened in the time that I was there.
Now, I understand just getting the job at WoWo was a pretty involved process, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, if you got an hour. Yes, it's very involved. Well, in those days, they were so particular about who they hired for air staff, and that's disc jockeys, also news people, that they went through quite a rigmarole, actually, because when I got a call, I was working in South Bend at Notre Dame, who owned the NBC radio and television affiliates, and that's where I was working. Got a call from Cal Stewart, his air name, his real name, Cal Bullwinkle. He says, Don, he says, we hear you're leaving the station there. And I said, no, I'm not leaving. He says, well, he says, we'd like you to leave. He says, we'd like you to come over here and see us. And of course, I was a big fan of WOWO, as everybody was, even though I was working in South Bend at a station, I still listened to WOWO all the time, so I was very familiar with the guys, and he wanted me to come over, and so I did, and from then on, I was traveling back and forth between South Bend and Fort Wayne for meetings and get-togethers, and they were taking me to luncheons, and the manager, who at the time, the general manager, was Ed Wallace. And he and, Tommy Longsworth, the sales director, and, several, about four or five different people, always sat around tables having lunch, and grilling me and talking and just feeling me out. And, of course, I had to make air checks for them. And it was quite a procedure. And from the time they called me till they actually called me back again, Cal called me and asked me if I'd like to come to work at WoWo, it must have been a good, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. It took that long before they finally made the decision. He said, well, he said, we had about 200 people who applied.
Oh, man.
And he says, you're down to the final four. And he says, after we've screened everything, he says, how would you like to come to work at WOWO? And I said, what time you want me to be there? And that's how that came about. Westinghouse Broadcasting was really at the top of the broadcast world in those years. And so it was quite an honor to get into WOWO. And my opening show on December 28th of 59 was done outside the third floor window of the Gaskins building in downtown Washington Boulevard. Our studios were on the third floor, and I stepped out of a window facing right down on Washington Boulevard, but I stepped onto a scaffolding because they were having some work done to the building. It was scaffolding that went along the length of the building, and it was about 3 feet out from the building, and this was a snowy, somewhat rain-mixed night, and I had to get out there for my premiere show. Onto that, and it was wet, and they had one of the construction engineers out there with me showing me where, you know, or it was safe to step. And here I got a microphone in my hand, and I got, you know, a copy that was getting wet. This is my opening show, trying to get used to the format and everything else. And, of course, they had the big name of the Don Chevalier Show, WOWO, and they had the Hollywood-type skylights, you know, flashing all over up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I broadcast. I did my first show from up there. And, of course, right away down on Washington Boulevard, the traffic started to pile up, and they had to bring out extra police for traffic control. And that's where I did my opening show. I was going crazy up there trying to get through that first three-hour shift or four, whatever it was. But that's how it all started for me in December of 59. I was on the night shift and was on until midnight. Sometimes one in the morning, they'd change it back and forth. And that's when the station would beam out across the nation and part of the globe. Bob Sievers in the morning could come on the air at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was on at night. We would get mail from foreign countries, people listening, and I got mail from all the states. I can vividly remember getting letters from a fellow up in the Arctic.
Really?
Yes. He listened to me on WoWo at night, and he would send a letter to me, and it had to come from his remote location way up in the Arctic by dog sled. And then I had a missionary couple from America, and they were down in the remote area of Cuba, which was more or less over closer to the Guantanamo area.
Mm-hmm.
And very remote. And they listened to WoWo at night. And I used to get mail from them regularly, you know. And so WoWo just got out and beamed all over. I remember getting mail from a sailor on a Navy ship, and he was from Indiana. And he said, on our ship in the Atlantic Ocean, we used to have WoWo on the PA system beamed throughout the ship, out in the Atlantic, the U.S. Navy.
That's amazing.
But those are just a few examples of how far out the signal got and how popular it was. And, of course, the mail that we got as far as fan mail and phone calls from all over the country kept us, when you were on the air, you were just constantly answering phone calls locally and long distance. I know Bob Sievers and Jay Gould early in the morning when the long signal still beamed out around the globe. They were always getting mail from Ireland, Italy, and when Jay was on, he'd get it from farmers who were always wanted to hear what Jay had to say about farming and agriculture. It was just amazing. People just liked it. Of course, we played the hits at that time. We were playing the top 40. We had our own hit list. Finally had one. First, we call it the Double Dozen, which, why, I don't know. And then they changed it over when we were the Air Aces. They changed our hit list, our top 40, to the Jet Set. So, you know, we played the hits and, of course, the record hops. We did everywhere. We did personal appearances and emceeing beauty contests all over Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan, which was our basically primary coverage area. And so they had us on the air all the time, and then at night and the evening we were out, our Air Aces basketball, you know, we played high schools all over the three states, who played their teams, basically teachers, you know, who had played basketball when they were in school. And, of course, we clowned around. We kind of did like a Harlem Globetrotters type of a thing.
What year did the Aces start?
I believe the first year was 1966, and I do remember the first game that we ever played. We were scheduled to play Bishop Dwenger High School here in Fort Wayne. They're brand new. It was a new school then, and big gymnasium. They had it completely packed full, and it was a big success. You know, the crowd roared. They thought it was great because we clowned around. But that was the first ever Air Aces game. That would have been in January of 1966. I do recall that. From then on, we went over to play in high schools all over the area. People just loved to have the Air Aces. When we came into town anywhere, I mean, they greeted us, you know, like we were royalty, you know?
I would say from a promotional standpoint, that had to be the most active period in the entire history of the radio station.
Well, it was the most active. The 1960s were the most active period.
Yeah.
They had done some things in the 50s, and they did a few things into the early 70s, but the 60s were really the prime time for all these promotions. They had us down at the river on Washington's birthday. We dressed up in colonial uniforms, and we crossed the river. That was a big promotion. We had a mob of crowd along the banks and up on the bridge top. It was in February, Washington's birthday, and we're in these colonial uniforms with muskets and rivalry and all that stuff. And, of course, some of these guys, you know, were peppering snowballs. Jack Underwood was in there. He was scared to death. But, you know, those types of things, it was just one after another. It was a promotion, crazy place. Now, Bob Chase eventually went off of the air in the afternoons. That's when I went from the evening to the afternoon, and Bob went into the promotion department. So he had a lot to do then after that with all these various promotions that we used to do. We had WoWo days up at Pokagon State Park north of Angola, We call it the WoWo Winter Wonderland. It was a whole weekend of Saturday and Sunday. We were overnight, and of course, they had thousands of people from all over, you know, travel to come there and see us. Of course, we broadcast it all, too, and they had us on the toboggan slide, chasing each other down, see who could beat each other in the toboggan slide, and all kinds of antics going on up there. And we did the same thing in the summer at Franke Park. We call it the WoWo Summer Sizzle. And we did a big deal over there with all kinds of games and activities. And they had the four of us, the Fabulous Four, up on the stage there at Franke Park, singing a song for Severs, Underwood, Chase, and myself. And then we had all kinds of contests up there, fishing in the lake and everything. It was just things that WoWo did constantly in those years, just constantly. It was just one thing after another. But it was an active place.
And you also have not mentioned the record hops, which were huge.
Well, what can I say? We not only had the record hops in the summer up at the lakes at the big pavilions where we would have a 1,000 or more kids every time, but of course we did them at every high school and, you know, in every service club and everything else, wherever people could get us in with the crowd, and we'd bring our records and turntable along. And
how many days a week would that be? How often would you be out?
It would vary, of course, probably three, four times a week. I was doing the evening shift. John Signa and I did the evening night shifts. So we were a little restricted at the time, you know, as to how often we could be off the air, you know, to go do these things. Whereas the other guys doing the morning shows, you know, they could be out more often. Of course, Bob Severs, he used to come back from, gosh, you know, pick any place you want, anywhere in Indiana, Ohio, Michigan.
Yeah.
He would come back from doing a personal appearance, and I would be on the air in the evening at that time, and I was there at midnight. About the time I'm ready to sign off the air, maybe even a little later than that, I hear the door open. Nobody else in the building but me and myself and old Estelle Bodenhorn, old Bodie.
Yeah.
The door would open, and here comes Severs walking in. I'd say, Bob, you got to go on the air in 3 hours. You went on the air at 4 o'clock at that time, 4 in the morning. And unless he stopped at Powers Hamburgers to get some of those hamburgers and chili to bring in there, and man, when he'd bring those things in there at that time of night, I'd about pass out.
You know, I had the same experience 30 years later.
Right.
Or 20 years later, actually.
Yeah, well, you know what I'm talking about.
Then. Yep.
But anyway, Bob would come in there, and we had a little room. This was in the Gaskins building on West Washington, and we had a room up there on that third floor where our studios were. We had a room with a ping pong table in there, and you know, just kind of a little place where you could rest. It had a couch. And Bob used to come in, and he would drop on that couch and go to sleep. And he had a little alarm clock. And all the years he did that, I don't think he ever missed getting on the air in time, not once.
He was a true Iron Man.
He was an Iron Man, and he was a one of a kind. I've worked with a lot of people in the broadcast industry, both radio and television, and there was only one, Bob Severs.
Yeah, and I have to say, he was doing that same schedule of coming in late at night 20 years later, literally.
And he wasn't getting any younger.
Yeah.
He was 40 years old when I went to work there in 1959, so, you know, it's not like he was a young guy. The rest of us were all in our 20s, but Bob, he maintained that schedule, and you never heard any complaints out of him and everything. It's just one of a kind. You know?
Well, and he truly did love being out with listeners. So even though it was a grueling schedule, he enjoyed it.
Yes, he enjoyed it immensely. And the feeling was mutual because that's the way people felt, of course, about him.
Since you first brought up the Bob Severs thing here, I want to ask you, what is your funniest Bob Severs story that you can think of off the top of your head?
Oh, well, I'll tell you one. He used to do, at noon, after he got off the airwaves, he went down onto Calhoun Street in front of the businesses there, and he did a man-on-the-street show. Every day at that time, he did I think it was like a 15-minute, and, he, you know, he just stopped people going by, you know, and chat, typical man on the street. And one time he was out there, and it was very cold. I remember listening to this. I think it was like about 4 degrees or something like that. He was having trouble getting people to stop. And this one young woman came by, and she stopped, you know, there and was shivering. And Severs says, well, he says, thank you for stopping by. He says, but it's cool enough out here to freeze your pants off. And she says, well, she says, I wouldn't know. I'm not wearing any. This was on the airwaves. Now, you got to remember in the 1960s, you didn't say things that were shady at all. You know, you'd get called on the carpet. And of course, Bob, you know, nothing usually shook him up, but that one really got him. He was dumbfounded and stupefied and mortified. You know, Jay Gould had a good one. He used to go on the air with Bob, and Bob would be at the console where the turntables and everything, you know, where the disc jockeys were. And on the other side of the little studio there, of course, was a table and microphone. That's where Jay Gould sat, and they chatted back and forth, and then Jay would do his farm reports. Back then, WoWo had an official slogan that they used, and it went like this. It says, you know, every hour and a half hour, you had to say that. This is WOWO, Westinghouse Broadcasting in Fort Wayne, Indiana, with the largest daily circulation in the tri-state area. This was meant to say that we had as much coverage area for our news as the newspapers, you know, the Journal Gazette and the New Sentinel. So it came on the hour, and Jay was getting ready to go on, and Bob says, and friends, this is Westinghouse Broadcasting, WOWO in Fort Wayne, Indiana, with the largest daily circulation in the tri-state area. Throws it over to Jay, and Jay Gould says, hello, world. He says, this is Jay Gould with the poorest circulation in the tri-state area. But we all had little ways that we tweaked each other. I remember one time when I was on the air doing my show in the late afternoon, and John Cigna, who followed me on there, was always playing tricks on me, as I did him when it was my turn. And they used to have a big swimming meet out at the McMillan Park swim pool every summer. And it was a big deal. So I'm on the air with my DJ show, getting near the end of it. Meantime, here comes the newsman. His name was Jim Slade. Jim Slade came in, and he handed me a note because I told him to bring me the results of the swim meet as it happened so I could put them on the air. Well, they fed me some legitimate ones, and pretty soon they handed me one in there, rushed it in, and made sure I was just at the point where I didn't have a chance to pre-read it. I said, okay, friends, here we are. We got some more swim results. Sam Jones there from Fort Wayne won the 100-meter breaststroke when he stroked 52 breasts in 1 minute 36 seconds. And I said it because I didn't have a chance to pre-read it. You know, I was reading it, and that's exactly what it said. And again, in the 1960s, you know, you couldn't see things like that on the air. Of course, I got called on the carpet for it.
But having had the opportunity to speak to John Cigna, that does not surprise me at all.
No, not at all, not at all. He was a clown, and he and I cut it up. Everything we did together on the air or when we were in personal appearances or air races, basketball, we were just cutting it up with each other all the time. We were kind of the nut houses of WoWo in those days.
Speaking of just that, WoWo, were you allowed to say WoWo on the air when you first got there?
No, after that manager I mentioned, Ed Wallace, after he left, Carl Vandegrift came in.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, Carl was there for a long time. So some of us, you know, would say WoWo, not very often, but once in a while we would refer to WoWo. And we got a notice one day, says, you know, Vandy says, cut out this WoWo stuff. It's WOWO. And so we had to quit saying that.
What year do you think that changed?
Oh, probably sometime in the mid-60s.
Just to kind of wrap things up, what do you think, if you could just pick one or two things from your era at WoWo, why was the radio station so successful in your view?
First of all, of course, they did have the personalities to do what they wanted done. All, you know, all these various promotions that we did, you know, all the guys were very much into that and were not shy. And, of course, the programming, well, you know, we played the hits and stuff like that. But the news department, the news staff was top-notch. And the public service and the Jane Weston show, which was a homemaker show for women, live appearances, and they broadcast them with Jane. And, of course, with the farm news that Jay Gould offered, all of it combined to make it a first-class, top-notch radio station with a big, powerful signal. And people just fell in love with it, and they wouldn't listen to anything else. There was a fellow in town, I will not mention his name, he worked at one of the TV stations. He told me one time, he says, you know, Don, he says, I'm the anchor here at the station. I do the news, you know, at 6 and 11 here on television, high-rated. But, you know, to show you how much respect I have for WoWo, he said, now, nobody ever knew this. I never told the bosses because I probably would have gotten fired. He says, but every night just before I stepped on the set to get ready, he says, in the newsroom, I'd flick my radio over to WoWo to get any late updates on the news. And he says, more often than not, he says, I got something I didn't have or something that wasn't as up to date. And it gives you an idea of that's the kind of a radio station it was. It had something for everybody, young and old. The audience ranged everything from little teeny kids all the way up to very, very old people and everything in between. It had male and female demographic. And the programming, that show I did every evening from 7 to 9 called Program PM, that was done on all 7 Westinghouse stations had that. And I was the host, and of course, similar to what you see today, I would have doctors or whatever the case may be, whatever subject on live. And we would get into a subject and let people call in, you know, and discuss all these things. That was a very popular program. And then that would be followed by the disc jockeys and all the music. And all night long, Sam DeVincent from Nancy Lee and the Hilltoppers, Sam did the all-night show music from midnight or 1 in the morning until 4 when Sievers came on. And all of that was pre-recorded music. It was recorded voices, and we had a machine that would play the records automatically. And, of course, oftentimes it would goof up, and poor Sam would be apologizing for introducing one record or one song, and it would play something else. But at any rate, we were on 24 hours, and it just had something that everybody liked. That's all there was to it. It was all of these things that made it popular.
Well, Don, we really appreciate you being so generous with your time, and thanks for all of your contributions to WoWo, and thanks for doing this interview on the history of WoWo.com.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.